in the times of stress, in the times of, you know, downturns, the banks which are not well run tend to have problems. So if you have a bank which takes disproportionately high credit risk in good times, and as the economic environment changes for the worse, a lot of losses show up in the form of credit costs, that bank is going to have a problem. And remember, banking is a business of large numbers. If all depositors of the bank were to ask for their money back at the same time, no bank can survive.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of Open Dialogue by Axis Bank. Over the past few episodes, we've been covering banks and how they operate. We've spoken about the liability side of banks, the asset side of banks, and the investments that they make. Today, we will focus on risks and particularly focus on some of the banking crises that have happened around the world. Joining me to discuss this topic is Neeraj Gambhir. He's the group executive at Axis Bank. Amongst other things, he runs treasury at Axis Bank. And we look forward to today's conversation. So, Neeraj, let me start. We move to the last section of our conversation, which is around bank failures. And for as long as banks have existed, bank failures have existed. I think we've seen many in the last few years. I think the biggest one globally happened around the GFC, the global financial crisis. But there have been before that banks in India that have, maybe they've not blown up that spectacularly, but they were rescued, right? Similarly, recently we had the SVB, the First Republic type of crisis in the US. Before that, we had, Yes Bank and, some cooperative banks in India. So, what will be helpful is maybe we take a few of these, and I'm also sure many of these happened because of very different reasons. It will just be helpful to understand what happened and so on and so forth.
So, look, two or three points. One is banking is a business like any other business,
right?
It may be tightly regulated. It may be something which is highly, which has a huge impact on the economy, but it is a business which goes through its own ups and downs, right? It's got its own cycles. Second, like in any other business, there are good banks, there are bad banks. There are banks which are well run, there are banks which are not so well run. And in the times of stress, in the times of downturns, the banks which are not well run tend to have problems. And these problems are in some senses universal. We've seen these kind of banking issues not just in one country but in multiple countries, and it goes back to what kind of risks you take and how well you manage that risk. Remember, the credit risk, the interest rate risk, and the liquidity risk are inherent to business of banking.
Right.
One of the most important jobs of the boards of the bank or the management is to make sure that these risks are well managed. And these risks are modulated in line with the economic environment. So if you have a bank which takes disproportionately high credit risk in good times, and as the economic environment changes for the worse, lot of losses show up in the form of credit costs, that bank is going to have a problem. And usually the way banking crises, reflect itself or sort of manifest themselves is when one particular bank has a disproportionately large problem, it goes through what could potentially start as a credit risk problem, converts itself into a liquidity problem. And the bank has to be shut because it can no longer pay back its depositors. That creates a fear psychosis in an average, household's or average individual's mind. And that creates some kind of a systemic discomfort or systemic sort of lack of faith in the banking system. And everybody then runs to withdraw their own money, from the banks, not knowing which bank is good and which bank is bad, and that creates an economy-wide problem, right? We use the word run on a bank when a large number of depositors suddenly demand their money back from the banks, right? And remember, banking is a business of large numbers. If all depositors of the bank were to ask for their money back at the same time, no bank can survive.
Yep.
Right? Therefore, the question is what proportion of depositors ask their money back at a given point in time and how well you manage that liquidity. Right? The other thing that I would like to talk about here is you talked about, you know, banking crisis all over the world. Please remember that, or rather I should point out that banking systems in different countries tend to have very different characteristics. US, for example, has roughly, at this point in time, 4,500 banks.
Right.
Small, big, community, state, you know, national, federal, whatever you call it. 4,500 banks. India, on the other hand, has less than 100. Right? Even though as an economy, we are equally large economy. US, the banking system is entirely private.
Right.
In India, it's largely, or rather the bank, if you think about this, the business of banking is still 65% of that is in the hands of public sector banks. Right? Likewise, if you go to China, again, very large prominence of state-owned banks. So, the kind of problems that different kinds of banking system go through is also a function of what is the construct of your banking system, what is the ownership of your banking system, and how granular or how prevalent that is. In US, for example, a certain number of banks fail every year, irrespective of whether it's good times or bad times, because some banks just take bad decisions. And it's normal, it's natural, and they don't worry too much about it. It's only when a very large bank fails abruptly, then they have a challenge. In India, we've not seen even a single scheduled commercial bank failure, even though banks have been resolved by a variety of means, but we haven't seen a single scheduled commercial bank failure in the last 25, 30 years, right? So, different ways of dealing with these issues, each central bank does its own thing, each regulator does its own thing, depending on what is suitable for their economy, for the system.
Right.
The crisis of SVB was very different from the banking crises that we have seen so far.
Right.
Right. SVB was not a very risky bank. If you look at pre its demise numbers,
right?
It had fairly good amount of liquidity, very small set of loans. A lot of its holdings were in so-called AAA rated securities, which are supposed to be safe. What challenge that SVB had was, it had bought a lot of these securities, which were long duration securities, at very low interest rates. So when US Fed raised the rates, the losses on its security portfolio, remember the AFS versus HTM, even though these securities were held in the HTM, the market worried that the losses on that portfolio are far exceeding the capital that this bank has. SVB had some other challenges. It was banking only one kind of customer, which is Silicon Valley. The name says Silicon Valley Bank, so it was largely banking the startups and the tech companies which were based in Silicon Valley. And therefore, a lot of this customer base was very concentrated and homogeneous, not heterogeneous, not thinking differently. So when the word spread around about SVP's mark-to-market issues on its securities holdings, a lot of people worried about the solvency of the bank, and everybody sort of withdrew a lot of money at the same time. For a $200 billion balance sheet, in one single day, customers demanded approximately $150 billion back.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Right? And like I said,
So that's basically all depositors to the basic, please remember.
It's like this. Banking is a business of large numbers. Yeah. If all depositors show up at the door on the same day, no bank can survive. And that's exactly what happened with SVB, and they just could not be salvaged. And then we have a few other such failures in US of smaller banks. Well, SVB crisis kind of created a notion in the minds of people that there are lurking interest rate risks in the bank's balance sheet, because banks, particularly in the Western Hemisphere, banks have been used to very low interest rates for a very long period of time. Remember, yep, interest rates in US, Japan, Europe were close to 0% for almost 15 years,
yep,
right? Which means that during this period, banks were making very low interest rate loans, banks were buying very low coupon securities. And as the rate cycle has gone up, a lot of these investments and a lot of these loans are underwater, right? Well, effectively, that was the notion, but central banks stepped in, they provided liquidity windows, and a lot of those fears were drawn out of the window. I want to, in the context of bank failures, I want to talk about a little bit about the Nobel Prize of 2023.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The Nobel Prize of 2023 was given to three economists. One of them was Ben Bernanke. Ben Bernanke was the chair of the Federal Reserve in US when the global financial crisis happened, right? And the two other scientists who were given, researchers who were given this, had done very seminal work on understanding the business of banking, right? And one of the, and this is late 80s, that they came up with this whole idea, and they empirically proved it and they theoretically proved it, that banking is what they call as inherently unstable business. And a lot of that relies upon the trust of the depositors, right? So it's unstable equilibrium. It's in the context of mathematical equilibrium. It's an unstable equilibrium. And banks can very quickly go from one unstable equilibrium to the other unstable equilibrium just at a very short notice. So they came up with this notion that the bank deposits need to be guaranteed or insured,
right,
by the state.
Right.
Right. And the whole idea of increasingly doing a larger amount of bank deposit insurance, particularly in US where the banking system is private sector, has a lot of failures, kind of gathered a lot of momentum after the research that they published. So while Ben Bernanke's was work about dealing with banking crisis, the work of the other two researchers was around the inherent instability of the banking system and how to deal with that.
Right, great. So since we are on Ben Bernanke and the GFC, maybe why don't we talk a little bit about that, like what happened in that context and what have we learned since?
So GFC was probably one of the largest banking crises that we have seen in a long time.
Yes.
Right. And the size and the breadth of this banking crisis was basically unprecedented. It started with US, it spread to Europe, and then to other parts of the world, but largely the epicenter was US. And it wasn't a crisis of commercial banks as much as it was a crisis of investment banks. Remember, preceding, prior to 2007-08, we had a great bull run in the global financial markets. US regulation had become very so-called laissez-faire, in the sense free for all. Right, very light touch regulation on the banking system, particularly on the investment banks. And over the last decade or so, these investment banks had built up business models which were inherently quite risky from both credit as well as from a liquidity risk standpoint. So the GFC started with subprime crisis. A lot of loans were being made to borrowers which were called subprime borrowers in US who were not necessarily credit worthy. When the credit losses of these borrowers started to show up, it started affecting the underlying portfolios. And these investment banks were doing a lot of repackaging of these loans and selling them as securitized instruments, right? You remember we had a bankruptcy of Bear Stearns, which was taken over by JP Morgan. Then there was Washington Mutual, that went through a problem.
Lehman Brothers?
Well, Lehman Brothers came a little later.
Yeah.
But prior to that, we had
Northern Rock.
Yeah. And in UK, we had Northern Rock. Even some of the institutions like Lloyds Bank was under stress. And some of these institutions had to be bailed out by the governments. Of course, you know, all hell broke loose when Lehman Brothers was allowed to go down on 15th of September 2008. And at the same time, there were serious issues about Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, and even Goldman Sachs, right? So, Merrill Lynch merged with Bank of America. Morgan Stanley got an equity infusion from, I think, a Japanese bank. And Goldman Sachs kind of got bailed out when AIG got bailed out with it, with which it had a lot of derivative contracts. Well, a lot of learnings of that episode that we have seen from a regulatory standpoint, right? The regulators have actually worked very hard over a period of time to tighten up the regulation to make sure that banks are today far more safer from a both liquidity risk management, i.e. LCR, NSFR perspective, and from a capital perspective. Banks were in some senses quite over-levered in 2008. So over a period of time,
Lehman Brothers was 3% capital adequacy or something.
No, it was much better than that.
Okay.
But still, remember, Lehman Brothers, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley are investment banks.
They were not deposit funded institutions.
Correct. They were all borrowing money from the markets.
Correct.
And they were using that to buy assets and run leverage.
Right.
So they were called shadow banks at the time. They were basically non-bank financial institutions. But even commercial banks were, you know, Citi had a lot of problem, if you recall at the time. Commercial banks also underwent quite a fair bit of stress, all emanating from the fact that all of them had risky portfolios and the credit risk started showing up. So what did the regulators do? Two or three things largely. One is that they increased the amount of liquidity cushion, liquid assets that the banks are required to hold.
Right.
And that's what LCR is all about. LCR is now a global standard for maintaining liquidity by the banks. The second thing, the amount of capital requirement that the banks were supposed to set aside for credit, for market, and for liquidity risk, they started going up. So effectively, banks were asked to deliver.
Yeah.
Certain kinds of businesses, particularly in US, which was the epicenter of this crisis, was pushed out of the banking system under Walker rules.
Walker rules, yeah.
Yeah. Banks could no longer run large proprietary
books,
trading books, right? Many such rules were imposed on the US banking system. So, the official regulated banking system in US has become far more safe and capitalized. And that's evident by banks like JP Morgan, which are today, you know, in the place where they are. But that's kind of happened globally. Also, that has led to emergence of newer class of shadow banks.
Yep.
You know, the private equity firms, the venture capital firms, all of these firms are basically taking over some of the businesses that banks can no longer do, the commercial banks can no longer do, and doing in a slightly different format, right? One of the hallmarks of what was done post GFC is that this time around, when US raised interest rates by 500 basis points, there was a lot of talk that something will give way. Some financial crisis will happen in US because US economy has not seen this level of interest rates in a very long period of time. But the reality is that none of that has happened.
Yep.
Right? It's been almost 2 years since US started raising interest rates, and US economy and US banking system continue to be in a fairly good state. So I think regulators can kind of look back with a sense of contentment to say that whatever they did at the time of GFC or post-GFC in terms of regulatory regime changes seems to have worked around this time, and we haven't had any kind of a major institutional crisis in this episode, in this phase so far. Touch wood, we don't know what will happen tomorrow, but so far the banking system
seems to have done well. And I think in addition to all the deleveraging, etc., also regulations have become, so as an example, systematically important banks and having differential both capital treatments but also differential supervisory treatments, or having these stress tests as an example in the US, which then go far deeper, right, than just one top line kind of a metric. These are all things that I think
there were a whole bunch of things that were talked about at the time.
Yeah.
For example, banks were supposed to write their own living wills.
Right.
Right?
Correct.
The idea was that if a bank is under stress, it should have a blueprint of how you will orderly unwind and resolve that bank. I'm not sure if that is still there and how well that has played out. But, you know, some of these thoughts, some of these ideas and notions of stress testing, more capital, large institutions to be regulated differently, banks having their living wills, many of these notions were created at the time, post-GFC.
Right. Last question, Neeraj, on this, and then we can conclude, which is, we've had our own versions of bank challenges, let me put it that way. Some of them in the scheduled commercial bank space, a lot in the, you know, the cooperative bank space. So, is it very similar to what has happened in the US, or do we have our own nuances that are
created? Well, the form may differ in some senses, but the underlying themes kind of remain the same. Remember, and I always say this, banking is 4,000 years old business, right?
So we are not reinventing anything.
We are not reinventing anything. It's just that old wine in a new bottle that keeps on happening, right? So, at the heart of every banking problem is one of these risks going wrong. The credit risk, the liquidity risk, or interest rate risk.
Right.
More often than not, in the Indian context, it is credit risk.
Yeah.
Right? So, if you recall 2014 to 2018 issues with the Indian banking system, you know, the stress test, the AQRs, and the cleanup that happened was largely on account of credit risk. The credit risk of lending to infrastructure projects was underestimated at the time when these loans were being made. Right? And similar problems manifest in smaller banks, similar challenges happen in many banks. Although I would say that in some of the smaller institutions, you do tend to have at times fraud as well. You know, somebody siphoned off the money from the institution, etc. But by and large, the challenges are linked to one of these three risks, which are anyways inherent in the business of the banking. But the question is, how well do you manage these risks over a period of time?
Great. As they say, Neeraj, history may not repeat, but it definitely rhymes. So, I think it's true for banking as well. Fantastic. Thanks a lot, Neeraj, for sharing your thoughts. It's been a fantastic conversation. I hope you enjoyed it as much as
I did.
Enjoyed it.
It was a lovely conversation. Thanks a lot for having me.
Thank you, Neeraj.
Pleasure.
Thank you for listening into this episode of Open Dialogue. I hope you enjoyed this as much as we've enjoyed bringing it to you. We are overwhelmed by the response that we've received and really look forward to your comments and feedback. Do like and subscribe to our channel to keep track of new episodes that are coming through. Thank you.